Support comes from Kappa, presenting an evening with Fran Lebowitz, March 6th at the Southern Theater. The evening will feature an unapologetically opinionated talk moderated by Ann Fisher, audience Q&A, and book signing. Tickets at kappa.com.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 17-year-old Logan Lane of Brooklyn, who ditched her smartphone 2 years ago and formed the Luddite Club at her high school, is at the forefront of the so-called smartphone liberation movement. In a New York Times podcast last week, Logan said she believes she's tapped into something larger.
I think the unplugging and the getting offline is 100% something bigger and something that hopefully this generation will take on, particularly as we become parents. I know, I have some regrets about how early I got my phone and how early this addiction was instilled in me.
Journalist Lulu Garcia Navarro hosts the New York Times First Person podcast and talked with Lane last week. Garcia Navarro is a familiar voice to 89.7 listeners, longtime reporter for NPR and former host of NPR's Weekend Edition. Lulu Garcia Navarro, welcome to the show.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
7 hours a day may sound like a lot for teens, but it's probably higher than that for some. And it's not just teens. I mean, there's a lot of people that are plugged in for way too long. In the case of Logan Lane, she began questioning a life of constant connection. What was the tipping point for her? What'd you learn?
You know, it was really interesting. She talked about being young and just always being obsessed with tech. And we can see that in our kids already. You know, they're always wanting to have their device, whether it's an iPad or an iPhone. But really, when things started to change is when she got given her own iPhone. So she had this very, very powerful device in her pocket all the time. And she talked about how it really changed her relationship with herself and with her peers. All of a sudden, she was on Instagram. She was on social media. She was feeling bad about herself because she was constantly comparing herself to other people. And she was really just kind of withdrawing from what they call IRL in real life and living this kind of virtual existence. And it became what she said, and she used this word, very toxic.
Yeah, she said it changed how she interacted with her friends, like literally how they related to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating to me because we've heard a lot of these stories about how having these devices changes people. I mean, we've experienced it ourselves, but to hear it from a teenager, I found it to be really eye-opening. She would talk about how all of a sudden she became obsessed with kids that she didn't even know, but she would see them on Instagram and she would be comparing herself to them all the time, that she was having relationships with people that maybe she wasn't very close to, but they had a sort of social relationship online, that she developed this persona that was actually not her real self, but was a kind of Instagram or TikTok persona to sort of attract people. And she eventually felt that this was incredibly hollow and that this wasn't really doing her any favors.
When I was reading the transcript of your interview with her, it felt like she didn't think it wasn't her.
Yeah, she didn't feel like it was her. She felt like it was something that she was kind of trying to put out to the world. And she was involved in a very difficult relationship, she says, with social media. She would kind of break up with it and then go back and then come, you know, and then break up with it again. She was constantly trying to get out of this loop, but she was finding it very difficult because all of her peers had phones too. All of her friends were also checking out what people were posting online. And so she felt like she was this very online kid, and she had to continue to be this very online kid in order to have relationships.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with journalist Lulu Garcia Navarro, host of the New York Times First Person podcast. She spoke with 17-year-old Logan Lane of Brooklyn recently. Logan Lane ditched her smartphone 2 years ago and formed the Luddite Club at her high school. She's at the forefront of the so-called smartphone liberation movement. Obviously, you know, the horse is out of the barn when it comes to our connection with phones and how much we depend on them. I mean, I remember when my parents got a second telephone line in our house and they regretted it because we were on the phone too much, right? So she went phone free for a while, but her parents needed a way to reach her. How does she balance being in a society where we are, all of us are very connected and enjoying her Luddite life.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that was really interesting to me is that she did something that we did not do during the pandemic. Most of us, we all doubled down on our phones, right? We all kind of were doom scrolling all the time. And this was the way that we were using to connect with other people and to see what was going on in the world when we were kind of having to be in our homes more. And she actually took a different view. She found that to be really depressing. All of a sudden, all the restrictions on screen time were off, and she just felt like she wasn't really living in the real world anymore. And so she did what she called this walk of shame, where she walked to her dad's desk drawer and kind of put it in there and said, please don't give me the phone anymore. And her dad said, haha, I don't believe this is going to last, as we all would. And she kind of took that as a challenge. And at the beginning, she says it was really lonely. She was finding it really hard to connect with her friends. But then you know what happened? She started sleeping better. She started reading books for the first time. She says she started enjoying having dinner with her parents. What? I mean, all of these things started happening for her. And she was even surprised by how impactful it was. But one of the things that really was hard for her was, you know, the connection with her peers. And she talked about it as if it was a social death, that all of a sudden people would see her in real life and they'd say, hey, where you been? As if she wasn't right there down the hall, because they weren't seeing her online anymore. And so that was the really, really hard thing. And so when she eventually started this club called the Luddite Club for people like her who wanted to disconnect from technology, they spend a lot of time talking about how they maneuver themselves through the world. And she does talk about how hard it is to sometimes not have your Google Maps. If you think about, you know, having to learn how to read a map again. She says she asked her dad how to do that because she had to learn, because a lot of our kids don't know how to do that like we used to. But she says it's given her a really good sense of how to move through the world in a different way. It's just had all these incredible benefits.
A club member from the Luddite Club, Lola Shub, a senior at Essex Street Academy in New York, referenced the nonfiction book Into the Wild, which a number of students have read. She told your New York Times colleague, Alex Vatical, that we're not meant to be confined to buildings and work. And that guy, Chris McCandless, the character, was the real life Chris McCandless, was experiencing life, and that social media and phones are not real life.
Yeah, Alex Vatical originally wrote the story for the Times that my interview was based off of. And I think that that is something that a lot of these kids are feeling. They're living in these two different realities, and we have this very powerful device in our pocket that is designed to constantly be pulling our attention away from where we are in the world. It's beeping, it's pinging, it's telling us that there's something really exciting, that if you just touched it and scrolled over, you're going to discover something new. And it's constantly dragging people's attention away. You know, since this podcast interview came out, we've had such an overwhelming response. I really do urge people to listen to her in her own voice, because there's something very powerful about how she details her experience. We are all feeling this all the time, that we're living in these two different realities. We're living in the real world where we have to get up, we have to go to work, we have to cook, we have to talk to our friends, but then we're also online so much of the time, and that is a completely different experience. And it's really, I think, confusing and conflicting for a lot of our young people.
What did she, you know, she talked about how she overposted on Instagram in particular, just way overdoing it, anything to get a click.
Yeah, she did talk about that a lot. And it really reminded me of the pressures that we're all under. And it made me think, actually, I won't lie about myself. As a journalist, as you know, you're constantly trying to get people to read what you're writing. And we've used social media so long for that. But for her, she spent a lot of time just kind of validating herself through social media. She's an artsy kid. She likes to sew. She likes to knit. She makes her own clothes. And she says at a certain point, she was doing that just to see how much sort of, you know, validation she could get from her peers, you know, if people were sharing her content, if people were liking her content. And so she found it really, really hard, because at a certain point she was wondering, am I doing this for the right reasons? Am I doing this because I love it, because I want to be creative? Or am I doing this because I just want to show off to my peers?
And be noticed.
And be noticed and be somebody. Yeah.
Her comments about the future and digital natives becoming parents is really interesting that she's thinking about that in that way. She spoke about the steps she hopes her generation will take to limit that constant connectivity. What are her hopes on that score?
Yeah, and it's really interesting because if you think that the iPhone came out in 2007, it wasn't that long ago for some of us, but for her, she did not live in a world without the iPhone in it, if you can believe that. And this generation is coming up connected in a way that we cannot even imagine. And so for her, what she really wants is to see people be more intentional about the way that they use their phones and to think about the reasons why we find them so addictive and why we're constantly pulled in that direction. And, you know, for parents in particular, you know, she thinks that kids have to come to it to themselves. It's really hard to enforce these rules and to make them disconnect completely. But having conversations with your kid about why spending so much time on your phone is bad, trying to pull, you know, your kid away from the phone to have digital detoxes. I mean, she used to go on vacation with her parents and her parents just said, you cannot bring any devices. That would force her to read. That would force her to go for hikes. You know, making sure that your kids are not constantly spending every waking minute of the day on these devices. You know, so many of us during the pandemic, we just kind of let it get out of hand.
Well, I was wondering to what extent parents are part of the problem, because I remember sending my kid to a camp when he was in high school, a month-long science camp. And one of the reasons why I liked it and was willing to spend an ungodly amount of money was that there were no devices allowed, not right. even an iPad, you know, nothing. And no, and then some parents started to complain. They wanted to change that rule.
Right.
And I thought, what?
I mean, I think this is part of the issue. You know, ever since this came out in my parents' group, we've been messaging furiously about this. I am the parent of a fourth grader, and we are talking about when we will give devices to our kid, if we should give devices to our kid. And let's be honest, there are real reasons to have devices, especially on children. We want to know where they are, if something happens to them, if they end up in a bad situation, we want to make sure that they can communicate to us. So it's not really for the worst reasons in the world that we're saying, okay, we have this technology. We want to be able to not just have our kid wander around in the world and have no way of contacting them. But what are the ways in which we could do that in a healthy way? What she did is get a flip phone, right? She can call, she can text, but she's not on social media. She's not on Twitter. She's not using this technology in this kind of very addictive way. So there are ways to get around this so that you're not using the iPhone or, you know, some other smartphone. And I think that's really the way that perhaps she'd like us to think about it. Do we really need this powerful device in our pockets all the time? I asked her, can we do Luddite light?
Well, I left my phone in the car.
Yeah, because for my job, it's not going to work. Like, I need to have my phone on me. But, you know, she said Luddite light doesn't work for me. But she does accept people in the club who are doing Luddite light. They just can't bring their phone with them when they're meeting in real life, when they're having these conversations and trying to be intentional. You know, she's not completely militant about this. This is her choice. She wants other people to make their choice, but she is trying to spread the gospel.
Is there really a movement, or are we going to look back on this 20 years from now and go, oh yeah, there was a blip. There was this girl in Brooklyn one time.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, she herself will say, I'm going to go to college next year. And she says, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I have friends who are already in college telling me it's going to be impossible. You need the apps to, you know, to check in to your class. You need, you know, to use different things on your smartphone. I mean, kind of all this technology has been integrated into our lives in this kind of seamless way. If you think about certain restaurants, you can't even get a menu unless you actually have your smartphone. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, she is cognizant of the fact that technology is creeping in this way into our life in a way that perhaps we can't resist it. But I think that's a good message to think about. I mean, it is a good thing to have technology. We do like things to advance, but do we want to be forced to have to interact with technology in this way all the time? And I think that's the question that she poses, and to me, the most intriguing one. Whether she's the leader of a movement or not, whether everyone throws away their smartphones or not, I don't know. But should we all think a little bit more about the way we're using this technology? Because again, this started in 2007, and just think about how our behavior has changed. We're all part of this vast experiment, and we don't know how it's changing our behavior, and we don't know how it's changing our brains. And so maybe we should think a little bit more about how we deal with the phone in our pocket.
Lulu Garcia Navarro, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's journalist Lulu Garcia Navarro. She's host of the New York Times First Person podcast. And yes, she's the same one that you used to hear as former host of NPR's Weekend Edition on 89.7 NPR News. We have more tech news, Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Globally, the U.S. has the highest percentage of older adults living alone, compounding the amount of loneliness and worsening physical and mental health problems. The tech industry has offered a host of solutions, from a robotic yellow lab retriever pup named Jenny to an AI companion named LEQ. But the rollout of tech buddies has been a bit bumpy. Wall Street Journal columnist Julie Jargon covers family and tech. She recently wrote about the issue in an article titled "Robot Pets and VR Headsets Can Reduce Older Adults' Loneliness, So Why Don't They?" Julie Jargon, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me, Anne.
What are some of the reasons there's been a bit of a mismatch between what tech companies are offering and how receptive some older adults are to it?
Well, there are a lot of issues that are preventing the widespread adoption of these kinds of technologies. One thing is just the fear of the unknown. How do these things work? What kind of data are they collecting? You know, there are definitely reasons that people have for being skeptical of new technology. Another is lack of tech support. Some of these innovative options require some technical know-how, and if you don't have someone assisting you to set it up and get going on VR, for example, it can be hard to figure out how to do. And then the other is cost. A lot of different options come with pretty high price tags.
You know, at this, you know, we talk about the lack of tech support, but that's something we all suffer from. I'm kind of wondering, you know, what happens if I didn't come into work and have people take care of things for me? But the stereotype of older Americans fumbling with technology and being intimidated by it isn't really the situation here, right?
Well, no, but I mean, some of these things, like, for instance, with virtual reality, it's so new that it can be intimidating to much younger people. So, for example, the metaverse hasn't taken off the way it was perhaps thought to do. And I tried out one of these new VR apps called Alcove, and it was my first time using a VR headset. And, you know, it wasn't as intuitive as I thought it would be.
And that came from AARP, right?
Yes, that was developed in conjunction with AARP.
So
once you're in it, it's fairly easy to navigate, but it's, you know, it's getting set up with the headset. It's downloading the app and figuring out where to go and how to hook it all up.
Well, what's the gambit with Alcove? What's the point of it?
The idea behind Alcove is to be able to facilitate virtual meetups with loved ones who might not live close by. And so you meet up with an avatar, let's say, of your adult child, and you can play, you know, a game of checkers together virtually, or you can go on a virtual excursion or just talk. So, you know, it's a really engaging experience, but, you know, how many people will use it still remains to be seen.
Right. That it's a free app. It's been downloaded about 600,000 times. What did a clinical trial find in terms of the benefits?
The clinical trial, at least the first phase of it, found that it does help reduce social isolation for the older adults who are using it. Now, that was conducted in an assisted living facility where the experience was guided. And this particular VR app is really intended for people with some level of cognitive impairment or dementia. And so that really does require, you know, in that situation, some guidance on the part of someone in an assisted living facility to get everyone set up with the headsets and kind of walk them through. Alcove is the app that's meant to be used at home. You know, it's kind of the home consumer version of it. But again, you know, in order for someone to use that with a loved one, not only do they have to purchase a Quest headset, their family members or friends also have to do the same.
The cost of a headset starts at like $400 and goes up. And of course, what are the user reviews been like?
Yeah, there have been, mixed reviews on those headsets. I'm not really looking at it from a user experience in terms of the headsets themselves, but, they're kind of clunky, they're heavy. Like I said, it's not the most intuitive thing until you get used to it.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Wall Street Journal family and tech reporter Julie Jargon about the tech industry's offerings when it comes to dealing with the high percentage of older adults living alone. We were just talking about an app that came out from AARP along with Rendezvous Inc. It's called Alcove. It's a home version of a virtual reality app, and it's now available for the Meta Quest headset. The drawbacks it's expensive, it's a lack of tech support, and a fear of the unknown, but does it help for those for whom those are not issues? Does it actually help with the loneliness issue?
Yes, that clinical trial with the Rendezvous headsets in assisted living facilities did find that it helped people feel less lonely and more engaged with the world. And I interviewed some older adults who tried other technologies that are out there who also said that, you know, virtual assistants, robo puppies, and the like have also helped them feel less lonely. So I think there's early evidence that this can be beneficial, but it just hasn't, you know, none of these have taken off in a really huge way yet.
Yeah, Jenny is a robo puppy, a yellow lab. You've seen it in person. What did you think?
I thought it was adorable. It was very, very lifelike. They worked with the Jim Henson Creature Shop out of Hollywood to design it so that it looks like a real puppy. I mean, it looks up at you, it does the little puppy dog eyes. It doesn't make the same movements more than once. Some toy dogs might kind of just repeat the motion, so it mimics the movements of a real dog. It was really quite amazing, but that is not available yet. They're trying to bring the cost down a bit. They expect it to cost $1,200 to $1,500. So for a lot of people living on a fixed income, that could be a pretty big cash outlay for a robot pet.
And is it something that you can like take with you?
You could. It doesn't walk. It's designed to be like a lap dog. So it's in a seated position. So you could definitely pick it up and carry it around on a pillow or by itself.
It's not cheap. What is the takeaway for this kind of tech going forward? Is there enough of an audience out there, or is there any sense about how the tech companies are going to grow this?
I think the audience is huge as the population ages, and especially as more older adults have cognitive issues and, you know, continue to live alone. And, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on people aging in place and not being in nursing homes and the like. So I think the audience is quite large in terms of the upshot here for the tech companies. Some of the startup founders that I spoke to said it's really difficult to get funding, especially for hardware. If you're developing an app, that's one thing. It's software, it can be scalable. Hardware is a little bit more complicated and expensive to develop, so that can be a barrier for getting the funding to make these items. You know, but like LEQ, for example, which is this AI companion, that has been tested in New York with their State Department on Aging, and they've had some pretty decent success. It's still early days, but that company is trying to replicate that model by providing those through different state departments on aging to get these products in to the homes of low-income seniors.
Yeah, LEQ, it's a companion robot. It's something that just sits on your desk, you said, right?
Yes.
And it initiates conversations. How does it do that?
It they trained this AI for about 3 years to really learn about the people that they're around. And so it can anticipate how someone is feeling, what they're doing. It can remember something you told it the other day. So when you wake up in the morning or you come into the room and it senses that, you know, that you're there, it will ask you how you're doing, say good morning on your birthday. It'll you know, sing you happy birthday. So it's a sophisticated artificial intelligence that is really learning about the people that live with it.
What do you hear from behaviorists about this and about the pros and the cons of dealing with the loneliness, the isolation, with this kind of thing?
I mean, I think there's always a concern that any kind of robot companionship shouldn't and can't truly replace human contact, and that it shouldn't be treated as a replacement for human contact. But for people who just don't have the availability of friends or family nearby, or maybe can't physically leave their homes much, it can be a good thing to, you know, have someone, something to talk to pet, to, interact with.
And by the way, this isn't just a U.S. issue. There's been slow adoption of this technology in other countries with advanced economies and aging populations, right?
There have, and there was a robot seal out of Japan that never really took off, largely because of the high price tag. It was about $6,000. So, you know, it's hard to make something that's sophisticated enough to be a true robotic companion and not just a toy. And it's hard to do that at an affordable price point.
Julie Jargon, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Julie Jargon is a family and tech reporter with Wall Street Journal. We've been talking about efforts in the tech industry to offer robotics and AI companions for older adults living alone. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Google has owned the search engine space for decades, becoming the go-to for fast information at your fingertips, as well as a verb, Google it. Microsoft would like to change that. The company is reportedly working to turbocharge its Bing search engine using a more advanced version of the AI technology that underlies ChatGPT. Here to tell us more, Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So we've talked a little bit about ChatGPT, man. It's been in the news a lot.
A whole bunch, often for very silly things.
Yeah, like Well, I mean, what I'm hearing about it is a lot of they're trying to figure out if the kid wrote the paper or ChatGPT wrote the paper.
That's right. A lot of times when it comes to, you know, trying to identify when something has been plagiarized or, you know, how it can be used in ways that you know that the sources where ChatGPT is borrowing from are consensual and not from sources where they've said, hey, don't take my stuff. There's a lot of questions to be answered when it comes to how that system functions and, more importantly, how it can grow. And Microsoft has decided that it's just really tired of losing to Google in the search game. Bing as a search engine has never once made money for Microsoft in the entire time that it has existed. It has operated at a loss purely because Microsoft knows correctly that there must be some competition for Google, otherwise it will consume the world. And in doing so, has you know kind of operated at a loss for a very long time. And ChatGPT is one of many ways in which Microsoft is hoping that it can kind of supercharge that engine in order to give people a viable alternative. There's actually going to be a fairly significant press event from Microsoft later today about how that system is going to work.
Oh, so yeah, how they're going to use ChatGPT technology.
That's correct.
To supercharge Bing.
Yeah, the general thought is that you know, Bing has the ability in this situation to become more conversational. So when you have searched for something, you can say, you know, I want to know where the three closest taco places are, and then you can, you know, immediately refine that search by saying, I don't want to spend more than $20. And you know, so you instead of you know being very kind of specific about the way that you're searching for things, the hope is that through something like ChatGPT, you know, and Google has had several you know kind of iterations on this as well. The idea is that it can become more conversational, so that you can do it either with your voice or with your fingers.
You know, the thing about Google for me has been all of the paid links at the top all the time.
Yes.
I mean, that's to me the biggest hassle is figuring out where the paid links end and the real stuff starts.
That has been an increasing problem for people who use Google for quite some time now, and it is extended not just in search, but also in looking things up on YouTube or in Google Maps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of places where it's difficult to know, you know, where exactly something is. You know, it's always a warning when you live in a place where you know that there's like really good food and you look up tacos and the first thing that Google recommends is Taco Bell, and you know there's like nine other really good places in the area. You know, so there's issues like that that have to be reckoned with. And you know, Microsoft is hoping that it can kind of step in and fill this void. It's also interesting to highlight that you know, Google is kind of taking multiple attacks right now. A very recent report suggests that younger audiences are not using Google to search for things. They're actually using TikTok and taking advice from you know, kind of people instead of a search engine. Which is a really interesting kind of twist that I think a lot of these larger companies were just not prepared for.
And so Microsoft is looking to invest $10 billion in OpenAI, the creator of ChatGPT, and they're going to supercharge it. How? They're just using the AI, the algorithms that.
So we'll have a better idea of how exactly Microsoft and OpenAI are going to work together later today, and probably more analysis throughout the week. But the general understanding is taking the ChatGPT, that kind of conversation format where the answers are not just, you know, kind of a very literal thing, but a very kind of conversational thing, and make it not just a part of Bing, but also a part of the Windows experience. You know, so being able to look things up inside of Windows could also become a little more, you know, kind of, you know, personable. I hesitate to use the word human sounding because there's very much not humans involved in this particular process. But the idea is for it to feel like you are talking to something instead of making a request and seeing what the result is.
What was it about Google that set it apart from all the other search engines?
The biggest thing that set Google apart early on was an incredibly easy to use interface and access to an enormous amount of information that was presented in a way that was very easy to kind of go through and interact with. You know, Google's homepage for a very long time, you know, kind of shattered all of the expectations for what everyone considered a good website to be, because it was a flat white background with a little rectangle on the middle and the Google logo. And it was like that for a very long time. It's still sort of like that now, but there's kind of more stuff on there. And that was, at the time, this welcomed kind of distraction-free thing. I'm sure there's more than a couple of people listening right now who remember MSN as a search engine and how just absolutely dreadful it was before Bing came along, because it was just so full of all of these distractions and things like that. And you know, given the test of time, Google has also walked away from that. As you highlighted, you know, search results are often really messy. And even if they're not messy, it's not often, you know, exactly what you're looking for. You kind of have to refine that search in other ways. Because there are so many organizations who have found ways to kind of put themselves at the top of those search results, even if it's not necessarily what it is that person's looking for.
So is this a shot across the bow to Google? How do you expect Google to respond?
So Google's responded very quickly in one important way. They've announced that there's going to be early access to its own competitor to ChatGPT. It's called Bard. I'm not going to bother telling you what Bard stands for, because it doesn't actually matter. But the idea here is that it uses a lot of the AI tech that Google's been working on for a really long time for a whole bunch of different things, using its engine that it calls Lambda. We're just going to keep throwing acronyms at people today. This is going to be fun. But the goal here is to, you know, kind of take a lot of its existing, you know, information and, you know, create this new, interaction point where people can kind of talk back and forth with this thing, and have it, deliver results that people are actually interested in. That is not going to be released in the same way that Microsoft seems to be promising its integrations. Google has made it clear that Bard is going to be open in kind of a limited capacity to what it considers trusted groups, to kind of learn in a bunch of different ways before it's something that is just available to the public in the same way that ChatGPT is.
And Microsoft is going to just open it up to the public, but do you know how soon this might actually be ready?
We'll definitely know a whole lot more details later today, but I'm guessing that it's something that Microsoft will have in a way that people can touch. I would guess by the end of the month, the way that they have the way that they've prepared for this press event.
Oh my gosh, those stories in the New York Times last week about how Apple Watches or iPhone 14s are they're reporting injuries and accidents. EMTs are pulling their hair out. What's going on?
This is really fascinating, and it's actually not the first time that this has happened. Apple announced a big feature in the last version of its watch, where if someone has fallen or has taken a nasty spill, and it is enough that the watch sensors has determined that it could have been potentially harmful, there is an option that can be enabled that will use either your phone or the satellite services built into either the phone or the watch to contact first responders and say, hey, this person has fallen. Here's their exact location. When the watch first came out, there were a lot of people who wanted to try and test this and see how well it will work and try and trick it. And one of the really interesting things they found was that one of the fastest way to test it was actually on theme park roller coasters, because of the kind of sudden start and stop that you get associated with a lot of theme park, or drops that you get associated with a lot of those kind of theme park rides. And so when this last watch came out, it actually was a couple of stories that had come out when the watch was first released, where people on theme park rides could actually look down at their watch and say, oh my goodness, like that's, you know, please don't call the first responders. I'm just on this ride. And so this is, you know, we've reached the winter and everyone is having fun on ski slopes. And so this has kind of come back as an issue that Apple needs to address. You know, on the one hand, there are people, you know, if you've ever been skiing or snowboarding, you can take a pretty serious fall, and it could be difficult, you know, even for the human eye to look and see someone fall and think, you know, that must have hurt pretty badly. And only to see someone get up and be perfectly fine. So this is technically a pretty significant challenge on Apple's part. But the company has recognized that, you know, that there are too many what it considers these kind of false positives, and have been trying to work on software updates to slowly, you know, kind of make this no longer a problem.
Well, how did they address it? I mean, is it an AI thing?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically it's, you know, all the different, you know, there are a bunch of special sensors in the watch that are tuned to the way that you normally move. So, you know, Apple asks you a whole bunch of stuff when you first set up your Apple Health account, including things like how tall you are, and things like that. And it uses that to add, you know, kind of relevant health data. So it, you know, based on it, you know, if you are 5'11", it has a rough idea of what your walking gait would be. And it uses that to determine like how far you have walked, you know, based on, you know, kind of distance and steps that it has counted and things like that. It uses those same ideas when you take a fall. You know, it is unlikely for someone who is 5'11 and 210 pounds to, you know, for your watch to have dropped 9 feet and then suddenly stopped without there being some kind of problem. And so it uses a ton, I'm being extremely general about this, but it uses a ton of those kind of scenarios to create this kind of, I guess, impact algorithm would be the best way to describe it. For things like car accidents and things like that to you know, kind of determine that something is not quite right and there may need to be, you know, some next steps taken. But it's, you know, it's difficult to test every single potential thing that is not a car accident to see whether it trips it up. So when the watch got released, there were a handful of things that Apple and its team had not accounted for. And the two that we have found so far are skiing and theme park rides.
So, all right. So my phone and my watch, I haven't been skiing in a while, but or to a theme park for that matter. But is this something I can turn off?
It is something you can turn off. It's in your Apple Health settings. You can set it to, you know, to not contact first responders automatically and things like that. You know, it is in this most recent version of the Apple Watch, it is in a section that is labeled crash detection, because it's the big feature when it rolled out for both the watch and the phone was that if you were ever in a serious accident, it would be able to detect that and then make these first responder claims. It is a testament to these people's skiing ability that they are able to ski it at a great enough speed and then hit something hard enough that it trips the hey, I think you were in a car accident mode and cause the watch to make that call. It's also quite difficult when you're in a skiing environment to like turn that off because you've got, you know, heavy gloves and, yeah, and a bunch of stuff, and like getting to your watch is kind of the bigger challenge there.
You know, in Summit County, Colorado, the 911 Emergency Service Center reported 185 such calls in the week from January 13th to January 22nd, mostly among skiers. So how are EMTs responding to this? I mean, they're kind of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, my concern is that this isn't going to get addressed fast enough, and EMT services may decide to downgrade Apple Watch requests in the same way that Wow. We saw very early on. There were a bunch of, you know, home security systems, like third-party home security systems that you could set up in your home. But they had so many false positives that they kind of get downgraded as far as the response rate for a lot of those things, which is also not great. So hopefully this is something that Apple is actually working directly with those organizations to try and create a functional solution. And it doesn't end up being something that causes so much background noise for first responders that they feel the need to kind of downgrade those requests.
The layoffs keep, you know, continue. Dell, computer manufacturer Dell, is the latest tech company to shed a significant number of workers, laid off 5% of its workforce. I know companies boosted employment during the pandemic, but what types of jobs are being lost at this point?
It's a really good question, and it varies somewhat depending on you know, the organization. We know that at Google, when it lost 110,000 jobs, a lot of them were from what are considered support roles. This could be anything from in-house therapists to, you know, kind of medical staff, but also, you know, several, you know, organizations within, you know, Google were kind of directly impacted if maybe there was some performance issues. We know from Microsoft, it took a pretty significant hit in its gaming department. Which lines up with, you know, kind of the decline in the gaming industry overall as people are getting back outside and kind of, you know, being a little more active instead of sitting at home. It looks like Dell's, you know, kind of regulatory, you know, filing as far as the jobs that it lost were not like, you know, kind of storefront people or you know, people who are in sales, but kind of evenly stretched between things like engineering and design.
What do you think it means? I mean, will these jobs ever come back, do you think, or are they going to get sucked up somewhere else?
Yeah. So, I mean, each one of these organizations kind of puts out the same general statement about not being sure what the future looks like. And so they're making these changes. It is interesting that almost all of these organizations are making a very similar sort of 5 to 7% reduction in workforce. And in many cases, that reduction does not equal the growth that was seen from 2020. So there's still more people working for a lot of these organizations than there were in 2020, even after the layoffs. So a lot of this is sort of recalibration, making sure that they're able to keep posting these, kind of growth statistics as far as how much the company has continued to grow. But a really interesting kind of untold story amongst all of this is how much these companies are also spending in severance. For a lot of these cases, the kind of external front for these organizations is that they're making these kind of immediate budget cuts in order to kind of stem the economic conditions that are coming forward. But at the same time, I think it was reported that Microsoft had paid just shy of $1 billion in severances in the process of letting all of these people go. That was just like a considerable, amount that would have equated to, I think like 6 months pay in some cases, which is a great severance package for someone who is in this really unfortunate situation, but is difficult to look at as kind of a cost cutting measure, for the upcoming year.
The sense about where all these people are going to land, they're all getting laid off at the same time. Is there a big shuffle going on or what? Because they're skilled, educated people mostly.
Yeah, a lot of these people are kind of college educated or have really strong engineering backgrounds. And one of the really fascinating things that has come from, a bunch of folks asking that same question is kind of who is hiring these people. There has been a lot of noise made reminding as many engineers as possible that the U.S. government is hiring for a ton of different organizations, be it, kind of security organizations like the NSA or places where software engineers are of kind of increased value. There's also, while a lot of these organizations have been kind of what they would call right-sizing and making some really interesting cuts, there are organizations that you would not expect, companies that you would not expect that are really actively hiring. Yahoo is an example. Probably not a name that most people listening to this have heard of in quite some time or thought about in a while. But Yahoo has been very actively hiring for a lot of these exact same positions. So it's interesting to see this kind of trade back and forth almost between these organizations. But, it's definitely a lot of these positions that are being released, there are just as many people looking to hire them.
Yeah, I mean, I've devoted entire shows to the dearth of high-tech talent in government. And this is an opportunity for government to scoop up a lot of talent right now then.
Absolutely true.
What else are you talking about these days? We have a few minutes left. It's the Russell Holly Show.
That's right. It is the Russell Holly Show. I know the last time that you and I had talked about this, the show had just started, but there has been so much focus, I think, on the show The Last of Us.
Yes, I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, I think one of the really fascinating conversations around The Last of Us are the moments in which it does not follow the lines in the game. The folks who wrote the game are very much involved in writing the show. And so it's been, a lot of times when a game gets kind of adapted to either a movie or a TV series and it is different, it is because a different writing team was involved and they had kind of a different creative vision. This is very different in that it's very much the same writing team, or at least the same, kind of leadership that are making these changes, either because they wish they had done it this way in the game the first time, or because they felt like it was better for television. And the response to that has been extremely mixed, at least on social media. In my opinion, the changes that I have seen in the show have been very much for the better. It has brought, kind of a context and certainly an emotional reaction to the changes that have been made. But this is, in several ways, kind of the first time that it's been done like this. And that's really interesting.
The episode last week, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before, was unbelievable.
I could have watched an entire show that was...
It could have been a whole movie just about them.
Yeah. I have a deep appreciation for Nick Offerman to begin with, just sort of broadly.
Right.
But yeah, he was very much the perfect person for that role.
Absolutely perfect. Now, this week was more standard fare.
This week, we definitely got a lot more. There was a look into what is very clearly going to be the kind of big bad for the rest of the show, and less, you know, kind of focus on explaining what the stakes are. I feel like that was made very clear for all of this. But yeah, we're definitely back to zombies are bad, and sometimes people are not great either.
And then just real quick, do you think that approach that they're taking to this television version of The Last of Us could start to change how other game stories are play out?
I would very much love for this to be the standard, you know, where the folks who were involved in creating the game are involved in kind of dictating how the show is going to go, and any changes are, you know, kind of very clearly explained by those folks. I would love to see that be a better, you know, kind of switch forward. You saw other extremely popular games that have been released in you know, kind of other formats in the last couple of years have just not been super successful. Mm-hmm. Uncharted is a tremendously popular game, and its cinematic release was just not super well received because they're, you know, very different groups that are involved, and the story just did not feel the same. But you know, it's very interesting to take a deeper look at this, not from a, you know, was it fun, but you know, seeing that just the process of creating this story is very different from what we've seen before.
The Last of Us on HBO Max. That is Russell Holley, managing editor for commerce at CNET. Russell, as always, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.